Tonight on Arena, Damien Dempsey live in studio with songs from his album Hold Your Joy and Peter Whelan on the Irish Baroque Orchestra's performance of Bach's Christmas Oratorio. #51551 is the text. You can tweet the programme at RTE Arena. For more than 20 years, Dubliner Damien Dempsey has been delighting fans with his music, 10 studio albums and astonishing live performances, including a one-man show at the Abbey Theatre last year, Tales from the Holy Well, which saw him looking back at his life at his native Donaghmede. At the end of October last year, or this year, sorry, he released Hold Your Joy, his first album in 7 years, one inspired by a book he had read about the Dalai Lama and Archbishop Desmond Tutu. You may have heard our review of it at the time, and we raved about it, I am glad to say. And thankfully we did, because he's in to sing a couple of songs from the album tonight and to chat with us. Let's go straight into one of the songs, if we can, Damien. Sure. Let It Go, you're going to sing for me.
Let It Go, yeah, Sean. Thanks for having us. This song, I meet a lot of people on my travels who... There's something from their past that's dictating their present, and it's stopping them from living life, you know. We have a short amount of time, a precious amount of time, a precious life for us. And so things from your past you can't change. Sometimes you have to let go, you know, if you can. You know, that's what this is about. I've been holding on to feelings from a wrong done long ago. It's like picking up a hot coal far to throw. If I'm gonna find some healing and cease this inner self-attack, no more pointless selfish loathing, wasting precious days that I won't get back. Let it go. Place in a little way, don't you know? If you truly seek forgiveness, you must find it within you. It will come with reparations and the good things you now do. Let it go. Find a way for to grow. Let it go. Just let it go. We can change somebody's world today in a little way, without them knowing. Can you sing it? Let it
song Let It Go. That's from Damien's album Hold Your Joy. And with Damien in studio this evening, we had Eamon DeBarro on keys there and Alan Doherty on percussion, both of them providing some excellent backing vocals, I have to say. And John Reynolds, producer, I think, was doing a little bit of singing off slightly off mic there too, helping things along. Damien, I mean, a song like that is so powerful in terms of the simple emotion it expresses. To what extent, when you were writing a song like that, yeah, you were saying this is for people out there who this. What extent are you saying, Damien, let it go? To what extent are you talking to yourself?
There's a lot of stuff. I think everybody has something from their past that is eating away at them, you know, that they really need to let go, including myself, you know. And things happen all the time that we need to let go, even, you know, during the week. And, you know, things happen, you know, and you're angry about something, and, you know, anger's not going to change anything, and worry's not going to change anything, you know. So I just tell myself all the time, let it go, Damien, let it go, it really helps, you know.
And I mentioned in the introduction there that Hold Your Joy was the title of the album from October of this year. Yeah. And The Book of Joy, I think, is the book by Douglas Abrams.
That's right.
That you had read. Obviously, you took the title, one inspired the other. Was there something in that that kind of started making you think along this? I mean, you're evolved. It's not as if you were, you know, not philosophical up until this point in your life. You've always been a thinker in that respect. Yeah. But was there something in that book that spoke directly to you?
Yeah, it was just these two men, you know, Tutu and the Dalai Lama. They've been through war and exile and, you know, apartheid and, you know, oppression. And through all of this, they said they had to keep their head together. They had to stay grateful and joyful, you know, no matter what's going on around you. You know, if you can try and do that, you know, you can do more good than you would if you let it all in and let it destroy you, let it break you, you know. Because it's easy to do that, you know, when the world is going crazy around you, you know.
And, I mean, I look at the album, Hold Your Joy, and, I mean, there are quite a few philosophical songs across it, but there are angry songs on there too, you'd have to say, or songs that are perhaps making a point, can I say?
Yeah,
Landlords and the Government, I think, possibly kind of explains itself. What was annoying you there?
That's just a housing crisis, you know. You know, in the 40s and 50s, like, the state was broke, but it was able to, you know, build massive public housing estates for the working people, you know, and all around in the cities, you know, and the small towns around Ireland. And now they say they can't do that, you know, when billions there, billions and billions, you know. So it's a lack of will, I think, you know. So I think we should push now for the people who are abroad, the Irish people who had to go abroad, for them to be able to vote. Because I think it's 144 countries around the world allow people from, you know, the country who are abroad working to vote in the elections.
So you'd like to see something like that, happening here. And James McLean equally was a song where you were keen to back him up on his stance around the poppy, wasn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, even the British Legion, they back him to the hilt, you know. So all these douchebags on the terraces, like, you know.
Yeah, he did get some serious abuse there.
Yeah.
We were talking about the album. You stepped out of the room for a couple of minutes before we came to her tonight. And the rest of us in here were talking about the album. Yeah. And I was interested, you know, there's a kind of an openness and a vulnerability in this album. Again, it's not as if you haven't always been open and vulnerable.
Sure.
But there's a kind of, for me, it feels that there's an extra layer of that on this album. And I wondered, the performance in the Abbey, if I can bring you back to that, which was a kind of a different performance from what you normally do in terms of a gig and even in terms of your shows like the Vicar Street shows that are coming up.
Sure.
Tell me about that show and what that added or how it changed the way you perform and the way you write, possibly.
Yeah, I suppose in the Abbey I could sing with a tender voice. You know, which I can't do on the normal shows, you know, because Vicar Street, nobody would hear you, you know, because everybody's singing, you know. That's, you know,
well, you can hear Let It Go, it's crying out for everybody to join in that chorus, isn't it?
Yeah. No, it's just the Vicar Street shows is me coming from sing songs and Dunamead and Coolock Harbour, Ring's End, all my people's houses we are singing. And I just wanted to trying the magic I felt as a child at these sing songs, I wanted to try and bring that to the big stage. That's what I'm trying to do. So, but in the Abbey, I was able to just pull back and just pair it right back and just use me. I have a soft, sort of sweet, high voice, you know. So I was able to do that on the Abbey, and that maybe influenced some of the, a lot of
songs. Yeah, because you had an audience sitting in seats in front of you, and there wasn't the same. Not that people are mellying around in Vicar Street or anything like that, but there's a bit more movement. It's a bit looser.
Absolutely. Yeah.
In terms of the audience participation, if we put it that way.
Sure.
Did you feel more vulnerable up on the stage? Was it easier to be open when you didn't have to? Again, not that you're shouting at us, but when you didn't have to, you know, make sure it was getting down the back.
Yeah. It felt very, it was terrifying, the Abbey. It was really a huge challenge. It was, but you had to open up about a lot of things from my past, you know, telling the stories. So, yeah, I suppose that would maybe that opened me up. And for some of the songs I wrote afterwards, you know, for the album, for Hold Your Joy.
Yeah, because singing a song about something is one thing, but actually standing up on stage and telling the story in words where there's no guitar, there's no melody to not hide behind, but to put some kind of artifice on it, that must have been a difficult experience.
Terrifying. It was, but I just thought, I watched my father in a hospital bed for about 30 days in Beaumont, you know, before he passed. So after that, I was kind of fine. I'm afraid of nothing now, you know. It's pretty good. On any experience in life, I'll just take it now, you know. So that just gave me, it killed any fear I had, you know.
Killed the fear?
Yeah.
Fear of anything? Fear of death? Fear of what?
Yeah. It just showed me, don't be afraid of life, you know. I mean, just get out there and do it. Don't be, you know, because we'll all have to pass over the great divide, you know. So just don't be afraid of people or what they're gonna say, or just, you know, stop caring so much about what people think of you, and, you know, just get out there and do it. You know, face your fears. You know, take a challenge on. You know, so that's why I got up there in the Abbey, and it was great. It was brilliant.
Now, we've mentioned the Vicar Street gigs, and they are 16th through until the 23rd. You're saying, are they totally sold out? Are they all gone? Or is it worth checking for tickets?
There's always touts outside.
Don't be encouraging them.
But there's on my Facebook page, Facebook, the Eminency Facebook, there's always people selling tickets who can't go, you know.
Yeah, so
there's always tickets for sale.
And they're just saying, buy me tickets. They're not looking to make a fortune out of you in the process.
Exactly, that's it, exactly.
In the process of doing it. Yeah. And then you were telling me then too, but just before we come about gigs in Kerry.
In the Kingdom on New Year's Eve,
New Year's Eve. Yeah. Are you ringing the New Year in for them down there?
We've done it last year as well, you know.
I was going to say a dub ringing in the new year in Kerry, but you've practiced it already.
Yeah, absolutely, the Glen Eagles. Yeah, it was great last year, so they want us back. So
well, I hope that goes well for you. You mentioned your father dying.
Yeah,
that was 2021. He died.
Was it 3 years ago? Yeah, just in November there. Yeah.
Was he how big? He was a big age, I think. Was he?
He was 75, which is old for the panel beater. You know, panel beaters, but all the fumes. You know, he was 50 years panel beating.
Wow.
And all them fumes. So. It's amazing that he got so many years, really.
And the song which is the final song on the album that you're about to perform for us this evening, "Love Is the Bomb."
Yeah.
The difference, I suppose. Can you talk a little bit about the writing of this and what that cost you emotionally, and where you have to put that when it comes to performing it?
Yeah. Some nights, if you think about the story of the song, you know. At his bedside, you know, just we were singing some songs and all, you know. But if you think about it too much when you're singing the song, you can break down and you can't sing it, you know. So you have to just drift off somewhere. I don't know, just.
But I guess in the writing of it though, you did have to send yourself into a fairly
not
a dark place, but an emotional place.
Definitely, yeah. I mean, I think something, you know, the bomb that came from the 50s jazz scene, you know. Something was the bomb, you know, it was incredible, it was brilliant.
Yeah.
But a bomb can also, you know, rip you apart, you know, and smash you, you know. So that's love, isn't it, you know. It's amazing, but it can just destroy you as well. But in the song, I realised, you know, that if you feel genuine love for somebody and they feel it back for you, I think you've won, you've made it.
Yeah.
Life, you know. I think
you don't mind being blown up a bit now and again, if that's what's doing it for you. Thanks so much for coming in to us.
Thanks. You might have to talk to the lads. I have to tune this guitar.
Oh, you have to tune. Oh, yeah. Is this the one? Are you going to? Because normally, for those, the uninitiated, the lowest string on the guitar is an E, and the highest string on the guitar is an E. However, your name is not Amy and MC. Your name is...
DD.
Damien Dempsey. So he tunes the bottom string down to a low D and we get low a nice D. big open bass sound. Yeah. And then just so that it's not all by itself, you tune the top string down as well. Yeah. So listen, you change your guitar there into Damien Dempsey while we're setting this up. The great live performances, as Damien was saying, 16th through to the 23rd. You can check out his Facebook page and there will be people who, for whatever reason, won't be able to make it on the nights involved. So you can check that out to see what you want to get there. The Glen Eagles Hotel on New Year's Eve, where he'll be ringing in the new year once again. And Hold Your Joy, the title of the album released in October. And here then is Damien performing live on the Damien Dempsey guitar, as it is now. Love is the bomb.
Thanks very much, Sean. At your sick bedside side, I sang you songs as you died. Two souls spinning through space and through time, slowly seeking sweet reason and rhyme. And then you turned to me, twinkling bravery, sailing off on an ancient breeze into many eternities. Love is the bomb, rips us apart, but makes us sing songs. Song into this song, it's an almighty thing when a love's genuine. If you feel and receive it, you have won. You have made it. There's a price you must pay when true love says your way. Nothing ever will hurt as much. Would you rather never feel its sweet touch? One again, love is the bomb forever. Yeah,
love is the bomb,
and ever I say,
love is the bomb
together. Yeah,
love is the bomb.
Let's feel it each day.
Love
Let's feel it today.
Love is the Bomb, the title of the song there from the album Hold Your Joy. Damien Dempsey performing live in studio with us this evening. Eamon De Barra on keys there, Alan Doherty on whistle for that particular song. And once again, Eamon, Alan and producer extraordinaire, and now we know backing singer extraordinaire as well, John Reynolds, joining in on all of that. Have a great Christmas, Damien.
Thanks,
all the best for 2025. Good to see you all. Thanks for coming in, lads. You're listening to Tuesday Night's Arena.
Oh, we've got visitors.
Sally Knox. Who's that with her?
Hello. I'm glad you're at home. I've brought a new neighbour to tea and I promised him some of Mrs. Cadogan's potato cakes. Mr. Shute was in the Royal Navy.
I was. And then this old cousin of mine died and left me his estate. It's most obliging, really, considering the fact that I'd never even heard of him. Whereabouts is your property?
It's in that triangle between Hierosolis and Castle Knox.
Oh, it's a great piece of luck for me, being so near to Miss Knox's place. I have no idea how to carry on in Ireland, but she's promised to make sure I don't go too far off course.
Won't you find life rather dull round here, Mr. Shute, after the Royal Navy?
Mr. Shute thought of buying a hunter at the fair tomorrow.
Oh, Sinclair, a hunter?
Now, I'm sure Major Yates would like to buy you a hunter until Trinket's colt is old enough.
If I can find one that is suitable.
Sinclair, I'm sure we will.
Now, Miss Knox suggested that we go together. I'd be awfully glad of your advice, Major Yates.
Oh, yes, well, of course, if you think, well, that is, I don't pretend to know much about horses.
Don't worry, Major. Flurry will be there. All you have to do is bring your checkbook.
Peter Bowles as Major Sinclair Yates, Faith Brooke as his wife, Lisa Ann McLaughlin as Sally Knox and Tim Woodward as Bernard Shute in an episode of the much-loved 1980s TV series The Irish RM, an adaptation of the stories of Somerville and Ross. Edith Somerville and Violet Martin were the women behind the nom de plume Somerville and Ross. These two Anglo-Irish writers, residents of West Cork, were inspired by the local Irish they lived among, and they created such memorable characters as Flurry Knox, Smiling Smiley and Mrs. Cadogan. New on the Christmas booksellers, or bookshelves rather, are reissues of The Irish RM and The Real Charlotte from River Run Books, and the preface to these new editions written by Claire Connolly. Delighted that Claire Connolly joins us now from our Cork studio. So what other studio would you be in, Claire, when we're talking about The Irish RM?
Absolutely. Thanks for having me on, Sean.
Not at all. Great to have you here. Edith Somerville, Violet Martin. You'd kind of think, actually, these two women knew each other all along. But in fact, even though you would expect that they would be moving in the same circles, they were old enough before they actually met up.
That's right. They were cousins and they sort of knew of each other. But it was a while before they met each other. And even when they met, Edith Somerville was leaving for Paris. She was going off to study painting. She's a very accomplished artist as well as a writer. And so it's probably appropriate that their kind of life together began with writing. You know, they were writing letters to one another and they continued, you know, they shared space over time, but they also wrote, you know, hundreds and hundreds of letters to one another. And they referred to the letters sometimes as bed sheets, as they were as big and as long as bed sheets. You know, they would record everything that had happened in the day to tell each other. They had a great ear for language.
And when you say they recorded what had happened during the day, was the material for the stories present in those letters? Was it something that the letters, you know, were they a starting point for some of the stories that they would go on to write together?
Definitely. You know, they were always really interested in getting down the way people spoke. And actually, it began for them with their own kind of tribe, their own class, their own Anglo-Irish class, especially the way the women spoke. They had this kind of familial slang term for the women being buds, like from Buddha, meaning having a kind of, you know, very austere air of reserve and whatever. And they compiled what they, or they worked on this thing they called the Bud Dictionary, where they, you know, they noted certain terms like saying decant instead of urinate, or, you know, saying touch of the crossroads when something was really busy. All, they had all of these kinds of phrases, but they were also, of course, listening to the people working in the house, the tenants, and the people they'd meet in the town.
Yeah, let's have a listen to another little section from the Irish RM. This is at a local dance, and this maybe gives us a different flavour from the quite Anglo flavour that we heard in the first clip.
Well, Major made a great reputation for himself in the country, and him an Englishman.
Thank you, Slipper. Mr. Marley, you don't find him a little bit too English?
Ah, sure, missing Yates, Your Honour. There's one thing the Irish never took to in their hearts, and that's the Englishman that to be pretending to be Irish. Sure, the English are the English, and the Irish are the Irish, and they understand one another, so they do. Like the fox and the hound.
Yes. Which is which?
Well, no, if we knew that, sure, we'd know everything.
There you go. A very different type of Irish RM
All we're missing there was Anna Manahan as Mrs. Cadogan. She's really wonderful.
Yeah, Anna Manahan was that. And of course, Brian Murray as Flurry Knox, yeah. Another unforgettable character. It sounded like Neil Tobin, that particular clip.
I thought
clip.
I was thinking the same thing.
Yeah. It sounded like that to me. But you mentioned that Claire Connolly is with us this evening speaking about Somerville and Ross. Because of these reissues from River Run Books of the Irish RM and indeed of the Real Charlotte. You mentioned their ear for dialogue. To what extent did they patronise the local Irish in a way that perhaps their society did at that particular point in time? Or do you think there was a genuine recognition of these people, as opposed to just some kind of jolly peasants, as they might have called them?
There's a letter from Martin to Edith Somerville where she says, you know, jokingly, she says, "We'll grind Carberry's bones to make our bread," Carberry being West Cork. And they're very knowing about what they were doing. They were, especially with the Irish RM, that was their big financial success. We might say now that the Real Charlotte might be the more lasting literary legacy, but definitely with the Irish RM, they had a very successful agent. They did commercially very well out of those books. But they were always, again, kind of listening to the people around them and talking as well. So even somebody like one of my predecessors as professor of English in UCC, B.G. McCarthy, who was a very stern nationalist, very critical of Somerville and Ross in all kinds of ways, says that they have an unbeatable ear for language. And they also thought a lot about how it should look on the page. They didn't want to kind of mangle Hiberno-English on the page. They wanted to make it kind of clear and readable so that the voices would kind of transmit clearly to readers.
But within all of that, do you think they were laughing at the Irish within the stories, or is there a genuine attempt to portray these people in some kind of rounded and nuanced way?
There's definitely that attempt is definitely there. I suppose we'd have to, you know, people would have to read it themselves and decide the answer to that, Sean. But in my view, they catch the voices. There's a kind of toughness to the humour. There's all kinds of questions of perspective always. Who knows what's really happening? Who's being fooled? Major Yates, of course, is more often the butt of the jokes than anybody else. He's usually the one who's kind of the reader comes to the realization of what's going on, usually about three beats before Major Yates does. And I suppose it's a kind of a joke as well that they take the name of the most kind of refined and cerebral poet of the age for the name for their kind of bumbling resident magistrate as well.
Yeah, because, I mean, you have to think that this was the time of the Celtic revival when they were writing these stories. It was totally at a tilt to what was going on elsewhere via Yeats. And I was thinking of Lady Gregory as well and her Kiltartan dialogue as a comparison to what Somerville and Ross do with their dialogue.
You're right, it's at a tilt to it, exactly. But if we went into The Real Charlotte, the novel, there you get a kind of a great sort of tapestry of points of view and perspectives and voices, again, a little kind of broader in range than you get in the Irish RM, and especially this kind of interest in women's lives, what women want. Charlotte in the novel, she really wants Roddy Lambert, who's a bit younger than her, very handsome, has a lovely moustache, and she also really, really wants land. There's a piece of land she has her eye on and she's desperate to get hold of. And they're incredibly good at giving you these kind of crisscross lines of desire and hunger and need, you know, in the novel.
And you mentioned the real Charlotte, and I'm sure if you say Somerville and Ross to most people, they'll say the Irish RM. I'm not sure how many people would follow it up with the real Charlotte, the novel. It was much more of a, or am I right in thinking it was more of a literary effort and therefore perhaps not as commercially successful as you've pointed out as the Somerville and Ross, or the Irish RM series of stories were?
It did well for them, but nothing like as well as the Irish RM went on to do. And they faced a bit of kind of family disapproval when it came out first as well, because the nature of the two women that are the focus of it, Charlotte herself and her younger relative, Francie, who's come from the north inner city of Dublin and is taken off to a kind of grand estate in Connemara. And one of the names they had originally for the novel was Out of the North Side. And another name was A Romance of Two Vulgar Women. So that'll give you an indication. And their family thought that the novel was vulgar because of the way it was written and so on. But there are people now who would say it is the greatest 19th century Irish novel. Terry Eagleton said that, for example, and I would certainly rank it as very high up among the greats.
Incidentally, Violet Martin, as she wrote under the name Martin Ross, and then Edith was the Somerville and Ross. To what extent that choice of the, even though she didn't use Martin, but that choice of the male Christian name, to what extent was that just trying to bypass the attitudes at the time, perhaps, to two women writing together?
Yeah, they were probably doing a bit of masking from their own kind of social class and connections as well. And they were very keen on being seen as people who co-wrote, you know. Edith Somerville says something like, two minds, two hands and only one pen. And that was really important to them. And people tried to prize out the secret of the collaboration to see, you know, if you could kind of part this joint stock company, as they called it. But they wanted to be seen as a kind of a writing unit. And of course, even after Martin Ross died in 1915, Edith Somerville continued to publish under their joint names. And she became quite seriously interested in spiritualism around then and began doing automatic writing and kind of channeling Martin Ross's voice.
And that's interesting again when you think of Yeats and you know,
absolutely,
his attitude to the automatic writing and his wife's attitude at the time as well to this idea that writing could just come into the hands. Can you, when you read it, or you know, have academics gone into looking at the stories in any way, Claire, and saying, ah, clearly there's Edith Somerville's voice and clearly there's Violet Martin's voice? Are there sections when you can see one or other hand at play, or is it truly the whole being greater than the sum of the parts, than the two of them together were something bigger than each of them individually?
Yeah, there has been some attempts to look at that and to think more about it, but it seems that they, because of the way they wrote, you know, one pen, but these two hands and two minds kind of working together, it's hard to kind of disaggregate the two different voices. During the year, I had the opportunity to look at the manuscript of The Real Charlotte. And the first thing that was so interesting to see about it was that the first pages and pages of it are written on an old ship's log that probably belonged to Somerville's brother, Boyle Somerville. So they're kind of just using up whatever is to hand and making their, starting their manuscript on every, you know, 20 or 30 pages as one, they do a kind of a word count and they notice, you know, how far they've got with the book. And then we can tell with Edith Somerville's hand, there are some little sketches that she made from time to time. She sketched out little figures to show what some of the characters might have looked like. And there's even a little map of the place. So we can see maybe her visual imagination at work at some points.
And Violet Martin's brother, of course, he was a performer, wasn't he? He rented out the family estates and decided to go off and make life for himself on the stage, a singer of comic songs and the like.
Including Ballyhooly. Yeah.
That was what Ballyhooly was one of his
was
big,
one of his hits. Yeah,
and that was that was lampooning the whole land agitation idea. How political were Somerville and Ross themselves in that respect, do you think? Did they comment in any way on the Celtic revival that was happening?
Oh,
did
they
get involved in the politics of all of that?
They tried to stay to one remove of it, but they had no sympathy for what Yeats and Lady Gregory were doing in the Abbey. They didn't think that was the right direction for Ireland to go, and they had some critical views of people, including Oscar Wilde as well. So, and they're kind of gossips as well, you know. So they're exchanging opinions about all of this stuff that's going on, and they're being, you know, they're going their own way, I suppose.
And I know you'll tell us we should read both or all, but if you were starting out on a Somerville and Ross reading adventure, would you start with the Irish RM or would you start with the Real Charlotte?
Well, of course, the Irish RM stories are short, they're funny, they're so engaging, you can sit down and pick one up. But I'd have to say, if you have a bit of time now over Christmas, do please try reading the Real Charlotte.
It's worth the effort. Claire, thanks for speaking with us this evening.
Thanks, Sean.
That's Claire Connolly, who has written the prefaces to the new River Run editions of the Somerville and Ross stories, The Irish RM, and indeed of the novel The Real Charlotte. Irish Baroque Orchestra will present Bach's Christmas Oratorio in two performances this December, directed by Peter Whelan, the IBO's artistic director. This festive work captures the spirit of the Nativity through six cantatas, originally performed in Leipzig in 1734. Acclaimed for his historically informed interpretations, Whelan leads a cast of soloists, a uniquely intimate 8-member Baroque chorus for Bach's Christmas Oratorio, which really is a timeless celebration of the Christmas season. I'm delighted that Peter Whelan is with me in studio this evening. I was this close to you last Friday night as well, Peter. I went straight in, hot-footed it in from the broadcast here in RTE into here. Most of the performance of Messiah in St. Patrick's Cathedral in Dublin. It was an extraordinary performance, I have to say.
And, thanks so much, Sean.
Not dissimilar to what you're going to do with the Bach Oratorio, in that you really go for that authenticity and to trying to get back to that period in time. What attracts you to it?
Well, you know, it's interesting this year that we're doing both the Messiah and the Christmas Oratorio, so it's a double whammy. You're getting all of the best possible Christmas music in one go. As far as Messiah is concerned, you know, we're always looking to try to recreate the closest to the Dublin original version. And of course, we're in the St. Patrick's Cathedral last week, but we tried to keep some of the theatricality of like the first performance in Fishamble Street. So basically you have very few singers, you have a lot of the soloists coming from the choir. And that's how it would have been in Dublin. Of course, Handel then had absolutely enormous performances during his lifetime. But the special hook of the Dublin performances is always just that the fewer people, it's much more direct. People are speaking to you and you can choose different routes through Messiah that make that the case. And the same here for the Christmas Oratorio, which is coming up next. We're going to just use 8 solo singers, which is almost certainly what Bach had. He always just had to hope nobody got sick during the Easter and Christmas periods.
Because he has an Easter oratorio as well.
Exactly, yeah. And you just have these 8 people. There's not that many singers available to him. So, but that's plenty. You know, it's hard work for the singers, but it does bring something very intimate and very personal to the audience, because you get to kind of follow these people who are singing both in the choruses and at you telling the story. Yeah. So it's very engaging in a lot of respects.
Yeah, and the way Bach composed it originally, Was that there were six different days across the Christmas period when these pieces would be performed, probably about, what, about a half an hour each one.
Exactly, yeah.
So then the six of them together, as you will do them in the upcoming performances, gives you a 3-hour evening, and you get the whole story from Christmas Day through until the Epiphany. That's essentially what the story is told.
The whole shooting match. It's not very often you get to hear that, especially in Ireland, to get the whole lot of it together, all six of them. And we just have a lovely team lined up for it. So we started rehearsing today, but I'm really excited about it and just to, you know, share it with everybody because it is so special. Of course, we love our Messiah and all the rest of it, but just good to have something new. And a lot of the musicians who are working here for years, you're just saying it's really exciting to get hold of this. We're very lucky this year that we can do both.
All right, let's have a listen to it. So Christmas Day was when the Christmas Oratorio started. It was the first performance in Leipzig, 1734, which is a little bit ahead of Messiah, isn't
it? That's right. Yeah. That was 1742. But it's amazing to think how close all of these.
I mean, it is extraordinary to think that they're 10 years or whatever apart. And, you know, that this type of music. However, we'll stick with the Bach now, and we'll let Handel go to the one side. He had his time last weekend. Here is the opening of Bach's Christmas Oratorio. There you have it, the opening to Bach's Christmas Oratorio, and that in a version from the English Baroque soloists as they're singing about the great joy. Shout for joy, exult, rise up, glorify the day is what I have written down on my page here in front of me, which is from some translation I found somewhere along the way. Peter Whelan is with me in studio this evening because the Irish Baroque Orchestra will be performing the Christmas Oratorio of Bach in both St. Patrick's Cathedral in Dublin and in Kilkenny Castle. Now, that's an interesting type of venue.
Yeah, it's completely different. I think the two experiences will be vastly different. I mean, if St. Patrick's is so atmospheric, of course, it's a church, so it's kind of like suitable for this piece. And then, Kilkenny Castle in a completely different way. I mean, it'll be just such an intimate performance. And for us, it'll be very interesting to share it in two very, very different ways.
Yeah, and I wonder, does the piece change in those settings, because obviously you're in the cathedral and this is sacred. It was written for performance in church. That was what it was, its original use was when Bach composed it, and indeed when Handel composed Messiah as well. Does it differ then when you have it in inverted commas a secular venue like Kilkenny Castle, or indeed as you had with Messiah, it was in the Opera House in Wexford?
Yeah, it's very interesting point, that one. You know, and I know we're flitting between Messiah. Yeah. They're two great pieces, and they've a lot to compare. But for instance, the performing Messiah in the Opera House or in a theatre like Fishamble Street would have been a theatre, and that was. That was part of the draw, I think, for the public back then. You know, like that you have this kind of religious piece, performed in a theatrical
fashion.
Yeah. I mean, Dean Swift hated it. He didn't let his singers go. He was really annoyed with Handel using his singers for in a secular venue, and he forbid them from going for the longest time. He was absolutely furious, and you can see why. Like, but at the same time, the theatre is a good place as well to tell these stories. And you know, these Christmas stories, and indeed the Passions, were often like described as entertainment. So they would have been going through medieval Europe that you know, there'd be things people would enjoy and probably get a bit drunk to it, telling the story at some point, like pageantry and all the rest. Now this is a much more sophisticated version, but it's coming from a place where you're dealing with an entertainment.
Yeah, and in terms of what Bach did then, because he did this in his Passion, his compositions of the Passions as well, where he has an evangelist. So is the evangelist, you're normally sung by a tenor voice, I think, isn't it?
That's right, yeah.
And the evangelist, is the evangelist using words from the gospel always?
I think that's it. And there's an evangelist as well in the Christmas oratorio. Mm. But the structure tends to be with the Christmas oratorio, like we've heard, there's a big splashy chorus or something very evocative. Actually, there's nothing better than that chorus you just played. It's like the beginning of Home Alone. It's just nothing says Christmas like the kind of rushing of that one. But you normally have a reading, which the evangelist will do, like you'd hear in a Nine Lessons in Carols kind of thing. Then a meditation, so one of the other singers will take that and run with it. Then there'll be a prayer type thing, which is normally an aria, and then eventually the congregation will be expected to sing or respond to that, so you'll have your chorales,
and those chorales would be hymn tunes that Bach would have used, hymn tunes, and then put the words into that, and it's everybody is singing the same word at the same time.
Exactly.
So it's encouraging congregational singing.
Exactly, everybody's involved. It's your chance as a group to kind of reflect on what's been said. And those chorales themselves, the Lutheran chorales, they often came from popular tunes of the time, of course, from like a few hundred years before, but they sometimes had very bawdy lyrics that were changed, you know, because they fit easily in
religified.
The voice. Exactly. And there's a very textured the whole thing.
There are, of course, we are dealing with the birth of a child in the Christmas story, and it's hardly surprising that in the midst of that there's a little slumber, what's called the slumber aria. It's kind
beautiful.
Of like a lullaby, isn't it, really? You would schlafe mein Liebchen, I suppose, sleep my little one, sleep
exactly.
little darling.
Yeah.
Let's have a listen. Marlon Horn is the voice that we're going to hear here.
Thank you.
A little section there of the slumber aria Schlafe mein Liebsted from Bach's Christmas Oratorio. There we heard the voice of Marilyn Horne, but in the performance of the upcoming performance with the Irish Baroque Orchestra, Peter Whelan, director, speaking with me this evening about it. Just 8 soloists. I mean, that is an extraordinary pressure on those 8 singers. Yeah. Two to each voice, is it?
That's right, yeah. And, you know, there's sections that they will sing, just 4 of them and another 4, but all of them will have some of the weight of the storytelling. Mm. And it's a big ask, but it's definitely what happened, and it's definitely what we like to recreate. And it definitely makes it feel a bit fresher as well. You know, you feel that it's like a marathon for them, and you're kind of rooting for these singers.
And it all always strikes me, obviously, I mean, part of it would have been in the vernacular of the day, as in it was sung in German in a German cathedral or in a German church in Leipzig. Yeah. So it was speaking directly to the people. And I guess when you have single voices like that, you really do hear it much clearer than you do with a larger number of voices.
Exactly. And then sometimes they'll play the role of the crowd or the rabble, and then you see them all in all of their different forms, and then they're singing with you in the they're kind of always transforming into different kind of attitudes and personalities as the oratorio goes on. Yeah.
And in those terms, to what extent do the singers, I mean, maybe this is a question more for a singer, but you as the conductor, I guess, would be aware of what's that. To what extent is there a characterization beyond the music, you know, that there is a kind of a drama that you mentioned earlier on within it?
Yeah, the Christmas story is different from the, you know, the Easter one, the Passions. It doesn't move quite as quickly, but there are definite character progressions and you know, different ways of imagining what's happening. For instance, like each of the 6 cantatas has a kind of a very different attitude. The first one is celebrating the birth. The second one is kind of focused on the arrival of Jesus and the shepherds awaiting his arrival. Then they're celebrating his arrival. Then it's his naming, and then it's his like you know, each one has a different
there's
attitude.
There's one for New Year's Day, I think, as well, isn't there?
That's right, yeah. And each of them then is scored very differently, and has like different kinds of wind instruments. The second one, the pastoral one about the shepherds, it's absolutely, we heard a little bit from that just now, but it uses 4 oboes, and it's the kind of sound is really similar to something like you know, bagpipes. So it's kind of like country style music. And then
There is a kind of a folk feel to it, which
absolutely, yeah.
I suppose Baroque music in some ways was the courtly version of folk music, wasn't it?
Yeah, sometimes I think they just got their boots dirty. They didn't mind being associated with the countryside. Other ones that are very noble with the 3 trumpets, you'd have like courtly music. And we have to be light in our feet to really characterize each of these. Mm. And each of the singers has to be light in their feet too, just in order to turn on a dime to be able to tell the story in so many different ways.
Well, on the basis of what I heard last week when I got to hear the most of Messiah, I'm looking forward to catching most of the oratorio again this Friday night when I'll be running in. I don't know at what point I'll get in, but I'll get in for the most.
Terrific.
Thanks so much for coming in to us this evening,
no,
Peter.
Thank you.
That's Peter Whelan. And Bach's Christmas Oratorio will be performed in St. Patrick's Cathedral this coming Friday the 13th, that's in Dublin. Sold out performance in Kilkenny Castle on Saturday the 14th of December. I always think you should check out even when something's sold out. Somebody can't go on the night and you'll suddenly find there's a couple of seats there. So you can find out full details on irishbaroqueorchestra.com. And that's our lot for this Tuesday. Paula Shields researched. Ollie Hamilton was the broadcast coordinator. James Feeney was on sound this evening. And tonight's programme was produced by Reg Luby. Back with you tomorrow night, 7 o'clock, here on RT Radio 1. And John Creedon will be with you after the news.